Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to Esoterics Podcast. You can't eat the sunshine. This is episode number 136, the second episode for the week of May 4th, 2020, week 8 of Mayor Eric Garcetti's Safer at Home Directive. And I would like to let my lovely wife, Kim Cooper, bring us up to speed on everything.
It's been such an exciting week. We actually went outside and it had been some time, but we felt the need to actually get the car engine moving and making sure the battery was working. So we swung down to Normandy Avenue, where our friends at the Save Normandy Avenue Preservation Group leaned out their window on their landmark block and shook their fists and let us know they're still fighting for preservation. It was super exciting to be out in the city, and now we're back inside and once again touching base with people who have passions for the history, the preservation, and the culture of Los Angeles, which is something we all have to, you know, basically maintain like a little herbal plant on the windowsill until we can all go outside again and look after things in person.
Perfect. Okay. Howard, hold on one second. We're going to get to you. Okay. So episode 136 is specifically about the Larry Edmonds Bookshop in Hollywood, the last bookshop in Hollywood, and how we have to support it in their GoFundMe campaign. The broader scope of this episode is bookshops in Hollywood. And so to lay the groundwork for the famous Larry Edmonds Bookshop, which needs your help, we are going to have our friend Howard Prouty, give us a history of bookshops in Hollywood and the predecessors to the Larry Edmonds Bookshop. So Howard, welcome aboard. Would you please properly introduce yourself? Your full
name.
Thank
you, Richard.
Okay.
Thank you, Richard. My name is Howard Prouty. I am a man who lives two lives by day. And for many, many years, I've been the acquisitions archivist at the Margaret Herrick Library of the Motion Picture Academy. And by night and weekends and other spare time, so-called, I am the proprietor of a used and rare book business called Red Ink here in Los Angeles. Between those two things, I don't sleep much, but I have a lot of fun.
Perfect. Excellent. And we'll put the link up for Red Ink. We'll put the link up for the Margaret Herrick Library, though I think the library is closed public at the moment. Am I correct?
It is closed. That's correct. We're closed along with everybody else for the duration of the crisis.
In anticipation of the lights going on again, will you just give us a few sentences on why people interested in film history should think about planning a research visit to the Herrick Library? Just for people that had no idea that there was a library associated with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences?
Oh, good gosh. Okay. The Margaret Herrick Library is one of the world's preeminent repositories of not just the things you would expect to find in a library, books and magazines and so forth about motion pictures, but an enormous treasure of archival materials, filmmakers' papers, organizational records, all kinds of original documents going back to the beginning of cinema. We're kind of a must stop for people who are in town doing film history.
Okay, that's fantastic. Okay, great. Okay, so we're after we talk to you, we're going to get Jeff Mantor, proprietor of the Larry Edmonds Bookshop, on, and he's gonna implore everyone to please contribute to his GoFundMe campaign to save the Larry Edmonds Bookshop, which is the last bookshop in Hollywood. So Howard, it is 2020. You've been a bookseller in Los Angeles for 23 years. I want you to go back to your first memories of bookshops in Hollywood and why they're so important. And that will lead us to today and Jeff's plight. So let's just go back to your first recollections of booksellers on Hollywood Boulevard.
Wow, that would take me back to 1973, which is actually 2 years before I moved to Los Angeles from Nebraska. I spent the summer here doing a film-related research project, and because I was so deeply into film history, The place that I made a beeline for when I got to town was Larry Edmonds. This was 1973. I had already had their famous catalog and had been ordering things through the mail from them. And so I felt like the guy who packed and shipped my orders, who was a fellow named Jonathan Benair, was like a friend. He was like the only guy I knew in Los Angeles. So I went to the bookshop and I said hello to Jonathan. And I spent as much time in that bookshop and as much money as I had, which is not much, during that summer of 73. I probably visited this shop, I don't know, 6 or 8 times during the couple of months that I was here. And then when I moved here in 1975, I would, of course, go back because film history was what I was into at the time, and eventually went to school at UCLA in that subject. So I was always looking for film books. And again, Larry Edmonds was famous far and wide. Even in Nebraska, I knew about them. And in Nebraska, it was a lot easier to read about old movies than to see them. So I was always looking for books, magazines, you know, pamphlets and things like that about the movies. So really, my book experience in Hollywood and on Hollywood Boulevard begins with Larry Edmonds. But at the same time, I had been a book hound since childhood, long before I was ever a bookseller, and I never considered myself a book collector. I never sought out the high spots, or I just wanted interesting things to read. So, of course, I would go to Larry Edmonds, but if I had a few extra minutes, I would pop across the street to Cherokee Books, or I would go around the corner to a little place called the Hollywood Book Service, which was kind of an old-fashioned shop run by a lady who I think her name was Helen Hall. And then I would work my way around Hollywood. I mean, I was always looking for film books, but I would go to other shops. And what I realized later in life is that several of those shops had a direct linkage back to the good old days of Hollywood bookshops. I don't mean to sound like the 1970s weren't the good old days. They were in their way. In fact, I have, as a memory aid to prepare myself for this, I have an article here from the LA Times in 1976 called Leafing Through Hollywood Boulevard, which gives the now stunning information that at that time, 1976, there were 16 bookshops on or immediately off Hollywood Boulevard at the time. Most of them were used in rare bookshops. Some were specialty places like Larry Edmonds, like Collector's Bookstore. Pickwick was a big general bookstore, but the vast majority of them were used in rare booksellers because there were just a lot of books in circulation at that point.
Who is the author of that LA Times article?
Ben Reuven, R-E-U-V-E-N.
Right. Yeah. That's yeah.
And it runs down. There's a little blurb about each shop. And so I'm looking at these and thinking, yeah, I remember Gilbert's Bookshop. Which was on Hollywood Boulevard, just east of Vine Street, on the south side of the streets, and on the ground floor of the Taft Building. Gilbert's, for instance, can be traced, its lineage, if you will, traces straight back to Stanley Rose, who we're going to talk about shortly. Edwin Gilbert, who was the proprietor of that shop, had been one of the partners of Stanley Rose and Mack Gordon back in the 1920s, a shop called the Sater Bookshop. Around the corner on Vine Street. Before that had been on Hudson. And then he ended up around the corner up on Hollywood Boulevard where it became Gilbert's Bookshop. And I remember the place because they had a fantastic loft that you could go up in, and it had all this old fiction from popular fiction from the 20s and 30s, most with the dust jackets on. It's the place I would probably head straight for if I ever got a time machine. I would go straight back there and just take all my money. My problem was at the time is that I didn't have much money. I didn't have a lot of disposable income, and I wasn't a collector. I was just a book hound. And so I was always looking for bargains. I was looking for cheap stuff. And I wanted film stuff. And so this jacketed fiction, which today would cause me to salivate, kind of like, hey, that's cool. And I would look at it and I would let it sit there because that wasn't what I was out to buy. What I couldn't have afforded to buy very much of it. I remember a shop called Cherokee Books, which was close to Edmonds on the other side of the boulevard. And I remember that shop particularly because I did spend a lot of money on a book there. I spent 25 $1,000 on a book there in 1973. That was a book that I very much wanted, and I was on the scout for a first edition of The Phantom of the Opera by Gaston Leroux, on which the famous movies were based. And by God, he had a copy. It was $25, which to me just was an enormous amount of money to spend on a book. But I spent it. By God,
that's like a month's rent.
Oh my God, it was just unbelievable. And, you know, I could have left with an armload of stuff from Edmonds for that $25, but I wanted that Phantom of the Opera, and so I got it. That was my big achievement of the summer. Honestly, in retrospect, that's about the only thing I did achieve that summer, was finding that book.
Howard, let me ask you one more question about Cherokee Books. That was run by Bert Bloom, yes?
Jack Bloom, I think, was the guy's name, according to this article here. He says he had two sons, Gene and Bert. So there you go. But he was the founder of it in 1950.
And we'll get into this with Jeff Mantor, but when you talk about the Larry Edmonds Bookshop in the 70s, you're talking about the location which is featured in the Quentin Tarantino film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Correct, just to the right of the Pussycat Theater. That's right.
Correct. Yeah. And Cherokee Books in the 70s is where Larry Edmonds' current location is.
Incorrect. Cherokee was on the other side of the boulevard, on the north side of the boulevard.
Oh, okay.
About a block or so east. It was in an old vintagey kind of building. I can sort of see it in my eye. It's probably still there, the building, I mean. But no, Cherokee was definitely on the north side of the boulevard. Let me just check the address in this article.
Well, it's quite obvious that when you get that time machine, Richard is 6607, not going to be your taxi
6607.
Driver.
6607. So, 6607, and Edmonds was 6658. So it was like a block or half a block east on the other side of the street. I don't remember there being a bookshop where Edmonds is now. And there was the one I mentioned around the corner called Hollywood Book Service. Which was a fantastic, that's a place you could have used for a movie location that could have stood in for the old Stanley Rose shop. It was, you would walk in and there were high, all the way up to the ceiling shelves on both sides of the room and tables in the middle. Just a very old fashioned kind of looking bookshop, leather bound sets and all that sort of stuff. And they had a sort of metal grill front, I seem to remember, like a fancy old Hollywood shop, you know? And it was always very quiet in there. I don't think there was ever another customer in there when I went in. It seemed like kind of a I don't want to say a dying place, but a very placid and quiet place. The lady was never very friendly either, as I recall, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, no, actually that's something I was going to ask, because when you went into Larry Edmonds and you introduced yourself to the man who packed your books, did he recognize your Nebraska address? Was he friendly and welcoming?
Oh yeah, he knew who I was. Yeah, because I'd corresponded with him. I don't know. I'd probably ordered from the shop half a dozen times and had things. And he can't have been sending too much stuff to Lincoln, Nebraska. So I'm sure it's stuck in his mind. But other than that, it was, you know, it's not like we had that much in common or anything like that. It was just like, hi, how are you?
Howard, before we push the lever and go back in time another 40 years to the 30s, we leave the 1970s, I just, in passing, because it's where I grew up on books, I need you to mention Westwood, because for me, Westwood was the easiest place. It was easier to get to than Hollywood for me. So bookshops in Westwood in the 70s,
I can totally do that because, I don't know if you know this about me, Richard, when I first moved to LA in 1975, I worked at Westwood Bookstore. Sorry. I worked at College Book Company. College Book Company was on Westwood Boulevard, and it was a kind of weird amalgam of a textbook store and a trade bookstore. The basement had the textbooks, which were, you know, catered to UCLA students, and the main floor was regular trade books, and upstairs was remainders. And I worked in the shipping receiving department for a year while I was establishing my California residency to get into UCLA as a California resident. So I remember all the shops in Hollywood or in Westwood at the time, including the great Westwood bookstore, including there was Campbell's was up right across from the campus. There was a not a B. Dalton, what was the other chain?
Really
awful chain.
Crown?
There was a Crown. There was a B. Dalton, though.
No,
too.
This is before Crown. This is before Crown. This is 1975. Crown came along a few years later. And I remember. This was a, what was that? That awful Walden Books. That was it.
Oh, yeah.
Awful, awful chain. Oh, God. Walden Books. You thought Crown was bad.
Okay, what's wrong with Walden Books? Why do you hate
Walden
it?
Walden
so?
Books. They just had the boringest books. You know, they had, you know, a lot of crappy remainders, not even really interesting remainders. And just the whole enterprise just seemed cheesy to me. And again, if you thought Crown Books was cheesy, Walden Books was like a step below that, in my opinion.
Okay.
Am I defaming Walden Books?
It's fine.
And then there were a couple of other shops. There was a shop over just on the other side of the Fox Village Theater, just to the west. There was a shop that I forget the name of it entirely, but I loved it because it stayed open 24 hours. You could go in there at 2 o'clock in the morning and browse for used books. It was like, wow, this is what living in the big city is like. You know, it's a 24-hour town. So I don't know even if that place lasted very long, but it certainly was there when I worked there in the village for that year and a half that I worked in the village.
Perfect. Okay. I want to stop on Westwood. I want to throw the lever. I've done it. I've thrown the lever.
Throw the lever.
Back another 40 years. We are at the intersection of Hollywood and Las Palmas. It's 1933. And I want you to bring us up to speed on the reason we're talking, the major reason, which is the Stanley Rose Bookshop. Okay.
Okay.
So
tell us
about this bookshop.
Okay. You've thrown the lever back to 1933, but I have to jack it forward to 1935 because that's when Stanley arrived on the boulevard. Now, Stanley Rose had been in the book business since the 20s. Let's jack it back just a tiny little bit to the point at which Hollywood was starting to take over from downtown LA as the book center of Los Angeles. As you know that 6th Street downtown LA was the center of the book trade in Los Angeles, the used book trade, for quite a few years, the early part of the 20th century, up into the 1920s, maybe even the 1930s. But it was around that time that there started to be the shops building up in Hollywood, the Seder being one, and there were others. Pickwick didn't open until 1938, but, you know, Louis Epstein had started downtown just as Jake Zaitlin started downtown. You know, that was where it was. And then people started moving west, and they moved to Hollywood, they moved to Mid-Wilshire, they moved even further west eventually. So in the 1920s is when you had a couple of the Seder, as mentioned, started on Hudson, moved to Vine. Stanley Rose was part of that, and then went after Stanley Rose went to jail for a little while as part of a piracy thing. They did a little, he and his partners pirated a popular book of the day, and Stanley took the rap and spent a little time in jail, and that broke up the partnership of the Seder. Stanley got independent backing and opened his own shop across the street, across Vine Street from the Seder. That was the first Stanley Rose bookshop. That lasted a couple years in the early 30s, and that went under. And then when he surfaced again, it was with new funding in the shop that we're talking about on Hollywood Boulevard next to Mousson & Franks. That's 1935. So that is the Stanley Rose Bookshop. That is the stuff of legend, where all the writers hung out, and where he had an open tab at the bar next door, and the smut in the back room, and all of that. That was the Stanley Rose Bookshop from 1935 to 1939 on the boulevard, almost directly across from where Edmonds used to be.
Perfect. And so we're interested in Stanley Rose as this precursor to Larry Edmonds' bookshop, the last bookshop in Hollywood. Because give us the golden thread, the metamorphosis.
The golden thread. Well, Stanley Rose wasn't particularly a book man, as it were. He was, depending on who you believe, there's a lot of mythology that swirls around Stanley Rose. Some say he was a bootlegger. What he was just an opportunist, and he saw this opportunity, and he started his business by taking books in suitcases around to the movie studios and selling them to the writers and to the studio librarians and such. One version of that story has him only taking the books in as a sort of camouflage because the suitcases had a false bottom and the booze was in the bottom of the suitcases. You know, you can believe that if you wish. But he definitely was a book peddler, if you will. And he had a personality that could sell people on things. This is one thing Lewis Epstein talks about in his oral history, his UCLA oral history, when he talks about Stanley Rose. He said he could sell a book. He could, you know, he was a good drinking companion. He was a very personable guy, and he could sell you a book. So eventually that led him into the bookstore world, you know, sort of in and out. He only seems to have ever had a bookstore as an excuse for people to hang out. He was by all accounts a terrible businessman. People stole from him. His accounting system was non-existent. He would take money out of the till to go next door and, you know, buy a round of drinks for everybody. He wasn't in it to run a bookstore. He was in it to have a good time and hang out with writers and, you know, make what money he could and spend it on booze.
Nathaniel West and Day of the Locust. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, among the roster of writers that are known to have hung out at Stanley Rose's bookshop, and it's legion, although I think some are claimed to have hung out there who probably only popped in now and again. But Nathaniel West was a genuine regular and a genuine buddy of Stanley Rose's. And when he was researching, if you will, the Day of the Locust, Stanley was the guy who took him around town, who took him to the cockfights, who took him to the dives, who showed him the underbelly of Hollywood, because Stanley knew all those characters. He was, you know, conversant with the lowlifes in Hollywood. And that's where Nathaniel West got a lot of his, if you will, local color that he then diffused into the Day of the Locust, which ironically, you know, the people don't often make this connection, but the Day of the Locust was published in May of 1939, and Stanley Rose's bookshop went out of business in July of 1939. So the appearance of one was virtually at the moment of the death of the other. You know, people had this idea that Stanley Rose had a bookshop for a long, long, long time. It wasn't that long. It was 4 years, four and a half.
Kim, on the boulevard. What am I forgetting, Kim?
Oh, you forget nothing, Richard, but you probably wanted to bring up Raymond Chandler because his association with the store is pretty legendary and kind of exciting too. And he too fictionalized his experiences.
Oh, we want to talk about Raymond Chandler?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you'd like to.
Okay. Well, the linkage between Raymond Chandler and Stanley Rose is such that people have said that Stanley Rose's bookshop was the model for Geiger's bookshop in The Big Sleep, which of course was famous or notorious for selling pornographic literature in the back room. I've often thought that's a little much because number one, Stanley Rose was not the only guy in Hollywood who was selling, you know, dirty books in the back of the store. I saw one article talking to Milt Lubavitsky, who was later proprietor of Larry Edmonds, talking about how that selling Tijuana Bibles and such was the thing that kept the lights on at whatever shop he was working at the time. Because it was a thing. There wasn't just one guy. Was Stanley Rose the most prominent seller of pornography or semi-pornography? I don't know. Maybe he was, but a lot of people were doing it. There's an entire book about this that you can look up called Smut Hounds and Something.
I thought
on my shelf here, but I think it's upstairs, so I can't tell you the exact title. Bookleggers and Smut Hounds. That's what it's called. And I think that Geiger's is just an amalgam of all of those people. You know, not specifically Stanley Rose himself, because for one thing, Geiger the character of Geiger in the novel is not really Stanley Rose like in any way. You know, he's a sort of sleazy little man, as I remember him. And Stanley was a big gregarious guy from Texas who liked to drink and carouse and, you know, go duck hunting with his pals and so forth. Not Arthur Gwynn Geiger, but okay, nonetheless, good. there was that scene and Chandler nailed that scene because Chandler would certainly have known about all of that as well because he was a Hollywood
good. All right.
guy too.
I want to start to bring us on home. I want to get to the metamorphosis of the friendship of Stanley Rose, Larry Edmonds, morphing into the Larry Edmonds Bookshop to close. But before we leave Stanley Rose, I want you to introduce us to Lewis Epstein of Pickwick Books and his dream about his friend Stanley Rose at the end of Stanley's life. I think this is a great way to say goodbye to Stanley because it's his death.
Sure. Well, Lewis Epstein was one of the great bookmen of Los Angeles. He started in the 1920s with a downtown shop. It wasn't on 6th Street. It was on 8th Street, I think, was Epstein's Bookshop. Moved it to Hollywood he opened Pickwick in 1938, but I think he had moved to Hollywood prior to then. And he was just, by all accounts, quite the upstanding fellow. He came, as he put it himself, he came from a nice Jewish family, and he was a good businessman and ran his place professionally and so forth. And he knew Stanley from way back in the 1920s, because Stanley was always around and always on the hustle. And he would tap people for loans. He would offer to sell books for them because he had clients, or he heard that so-and-so was looking for a nice bound set of Shakespeare or something like that. And he would know that Lewis Epstein or someone had that book, and he would basically broker the deal. So Lewis Epstein knew him for 25 years. And in his oral history, which is, you can find online, it's called The Way Things Were, and it's in two volumes, it's hundreds of pages, and it's absolutely fantastic because he was interviewed in 1977, he remembered everybody. There's a lot of personal information about all the great LA bookmen, including Stanley Rose. He talks about him for quite a long time, including after his shop closed in 1939, how he was still around town. He was still, working whatever hustle he could to make some money. He was a literary agent for a while and a good friend of William Saroyan's. He brokered the sale of The Human Comedy, Saroyan's book to MGM for the 1943 movie. Sort of Saroyan let him do that as a favor. But Epstein talks about how he was always coming around and he would again tap him for a loan, or he would have some books to sell him. And he was very adamant, Lewis Epstein was very adamant how Stanley always paid his debts. He never left him hanging. He wasn't just a bum. But he had a serious drinking problem, and it got worse as the 40s went on. At one point later in his life, later in Stanley's life, circa 1950, Lewis Epstein says, people, friends of Stanley said, why don't you give him a job? You know, so he doesn't, because he was living by that time in a little flea bag hotel around the corner from Pickwick, and he didn't have any money to buy clothes. So people like give him clothes and things like that. He was really on the outs. And so Lewis Epstein gave him a job, and he worked there for 5 days. Being a stock clerk or whatever. And he said he went to Lewis Epstein. He said, I can't do it. I can't do this. And so he just kind of drifted away and got sick. I think he ended up with tuberculosis. He ended up in the old soldier's home, not the VA hospital over in Westwood. But to bring it back to the story that I know you want to hear, Lewis Epstein goes into this in his oral history. It's really quite sort of stunning. He talks about a dream that he had, which is very strange because he's talking about all his memories of the bookstores, and suddenly he starts talking about this weird dream he had about a month before Stanley Rose died. He dreamed he was at a funeral. He's at Stanley Rose's funeral in a very dark room. He remembers a lot of detail, and there were only a couple of other people there. And he felt very awkward, and he didn't know what to do. So he went up to the coffin, and he said a Kaddish over Stanley Rose's body, even though Stanley wasn't Jewish. And the Kaddish is apparently something that you only say after the person has been buried. You don't say it to their corpse. But so this troubled him that it was the only thing in his dream that he could think of to do for his longtime friend Stanley, for whom he had great regard and a lot of pity as well. And then a month later, Stanley Rose died. It was 1954.
That's beautiful, Howard. That's beautiful. Howard, I want you to take a breath.
Well, thank me. Thank you.
You have done a fantastic job. You have one more task in front of you. You've taken us by the hand. You have marched us through the 1970s. You have marched us through the 1930s, up and down Hollywood Boulevard, talking about booksellers. I am so delighted. We are going to turn it over. We're going to come into focus with Jeff Mantor, proprietor of the Larry Edmonds Bookshop.
Okay.
In like 30 seconds, I need you to set up, before we talk to Jeff, Larry Edmonds and how it was sort of the collection of books sort of metamorphosized from the Stanley Rose Bookshop into the Larry Edmonds Bookshop, and then we'll let you go.
Okay. The shortest way to talk about the connection between Stanley Rose and Larry Edmonds is just to note that Larry Edmonds was a real guy, and that he worked for Stanley Rose in the bookshop on Hollywood Boulevard. I have seen accounts that said they were partners in the shop. I don't really believe that's true, but they were. He did work there, and he left at some point. One account says that they were both sort of drinkers, and they fought, and Larry left. He went to work at a place called the Book of the Day shop, and then he opened up his own shop on. Was it on Hudson? I forget now. It was not on the Boulevard. And I'm not sure it was called Larry Edmonds. Jeff would know this. But he did open up his own shop, and then shortly thereafter he committed suicide. And his partner at the time, I think, was one of the Lubavitskys, and just kept the shop going. And then I'm not quite sure if it was named the Larry Edmonds Bookshop at that time, or if it changed its name later when they moved on to the Boulevard, which I think was in the early 50s. But nonetheless, and it also was not what it didn't start out to be what it turned out to be, which is a specialist bookshop in motion pictures. It was more of a general used bookshop. But nonetheless, the direct linkage is there. Larry Edmonds worked with and for Stanley Rose, and therefore, you know, that's the DNA of the Larry Edmonds shop. And the fact that it's now become the last bookshop in Hollywood, not just the last used bookshop, the last bookshop, period. I don't think there's another shop in the vicinity, is there?
No.
No, and that's the last
that's,
one.
That's why we need to treasure it, you know, and then all props to Jeff for all he's done to keep that shop going.
Okay.
Amen to that, my friend.
Kim, has Howard forgotten anything? I want to get us to Jeff.
We are going to let you go, but I'm not going to let you go without mentioning that all we do all year long is look forward to visiting you at antiquarian book fairs when you bring out all of your goodies. And although when you were a young book hound, you could not collect all of those fiction books with the extraordinary full color covers, now you have quite a line in them, and you have a gift.
I'm trying to make up for lost time.
And not only do you find them and sell them, but you research them. You put these beautiful full color catalogs together, and you really share the wealth of your discoveries. And you know, although Larry Edmonds is the only bookshop left standing, I really think of you and what you do very much as in that tradition, and I'm glad that you're here.
Oh, well, thanks.
You stick around
nice to
too.
I wish I could do a GoFundMe for you, Julie. No, I hope not. I wish I could put out catalogs more often. They're very labor intensive.
Yes.
You know, they're fun to do, but they are difficult. I can at least say that I have several in the works. One may in fact appear within the next year or so. You never can tell.
Well, thanks for giving me something to look forward to. That is exciting.
Howard, you did it. I want to thank you. And it's such a pleasure to have you and talk to you. You really set this up really nicely. So hold on to your hats, because I'm going to wrap it up with you once we start recording. And everyone listening, hold on to your hats, because we're going to play the bumper, our bumper theme song, and then we'll magically appear with Jeff Mantor, proprietor of Larry Edmonds Bookshop. So everyone, thank Howard. And
thank you, Richard. Tuned.
My name is Swami Atmatatvananda. I'm in the dining room of the Vedanta Society of Southern California, the monastery. And you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Jeff Mantor, you are the proprietor of Larry Edmonds Bookshop. You are the last bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard. And you are in the third week, I believe, of your GoFundMe campaign. So please, let's just start with this important message about your GoFundMe campaign.
Hi there, my name is Jeff Mantor, and yeah, we basically reached a point where I was attempting to do whatever means were necessary as the rules were changing in the wake of the pandemic to keep the store going with mail order, to try to come up with other initiatives that would be fundraisers to help out with the store. And basically, as a one-man team, I was just discovering that I was not able to sustain anything that was going to work over the long period of time. I needed something that was going to be what we do here and expand upon what people love about this store into an area where, frankly, we're not up to speed, which is on the internet and having viable options for customers to shop in that fashion. I realized this was the only way to do it, and operating expenses had to be met, and I needed the resources to save this bookstore and to make it something that could, you know, remain here beyond the short term of what we're doing, which is going to be missing a lot of international tourists and a lot of live events, which are two things that I've always prided our store on being very, very good at.
Perfect. And so just bare bones, what is the goal of the GoFundMe campaign and where are you right now?
Save Larry Edmonds is the hashtag for the GoFundMe campaign. If anybody wants to read any of what I've posted in regard to that in more detail. And we posted a goal of $100,000 to keep our inventory strong, to rebuild technologically here with the equipment we need to build the facilities that are going to have a wonderful website here that's going to be a virtual event showcase, hopefully, to really help a lot of our customers that are truly worldwide. And I'm trying to use the silver lining of all the love and donations and help to, as a fuel here, to continue what I think is the legacy of this wonderful store that all of these people have realized has some significance.
Perfect. And as of today, Giving Tuesday, where are you in terms of reaching your goal? How far along are you?
I'm happy to report we are about $37,000 into that campaign at this
moment. Not bad.
It's been really wonderful and really humbling to get the responses and the donations from our own people.
Well, you deserve it. I think that's just wonderful.
Well, okay, good. So I think Kim has this great question, which we talked about with you right before we hit record. So Kim, do you want to set this up for Jeff, his story in the bookshop?
Yeah, well, I'm really interested in how you're a rock and roll guy, and somehow you ended up in a bookstore, and this has become your life. And I just wondered, what was the Hollywood that you found when you came here? What were you looking for? And what's been the adventure that's led you to sit up in that loft and be in charge of this very old LA landmark?
The adventure. We all have a lot of great LA adventures. If you were here in the 70s or the 80s, you have a lot of adventures. I came here, I was in a band, and I came here to be a musician, and it was the 80s, and there was a lot of acting on. It was a wonderful place. I took a job working at Book City, which was a great bookstore here in Hollywood Boulevard for 25 plus years, and it was a wonderful introduction to Hollywood. It was a wonderful introduction to the book community. And I met so many amazing people that still some are a part of my life even now today. From my position there, I made friends with a gentleman who worked at Larry Edmonds. And Larry Edmonds was always the kind of a gold standard job in what was a sea of bookstores there. This was always considered a really great place to work. And when an opportunity finally opened up, I took a job here as the stock boy. By then I was going to film school and trying to work on projects like that and still doing musical things. But this was going to be my job until, I hit the big time. And slowly but surely, this place just became more and more a part of my life. It took on a new significance when I had my own family as well. I was a little more grounded. I just took on more responsibility here slowly but surely. And I mean, this is my home. I love this place.
Excellent. Tell us about Git.
Git Poland was one of the owners of the Larry Edmonds Bookshop. Her husband was Milt Lubavitsky. The two of them basically, Larry Edmonds was a nameplate only and kind of out of the store very early on, but the name remained. The husband and wife team of Git and Milt kept the store rolling, and Git at a certain point decides that she's going to do a special kind of pamphlet to advertise the store's unique merchandise in the specific areas of film. And that included equipment and scripts and scores, things like Bernard Herrmann's Citizen Kane score rolled through here, various items like that. And she sends this out to film schools and universities and gets a really positive response and realizes that this is kind of a niche market that a lot of people around the country and around the world are very interested in. This catalog gets expanded upon, becomes bigger and bigger, becomes even a reference for bibliography, to look for source material. And slowly but surely, the film aspect of this bookstore becomes more and more a part of what we do.
Perfect. And so then, without stopping, Larry McMurtry walks into the shop 1962, and how does that transform the shop?
Yeah, Larry McMurtry was a customer here for a very long time, and at one point Larry McMurtry comes in and makes an offer basically to buy out the first editions in the non-cinema related field. And Milton Git make a decision at that point to basically make this a film specialty store, where we're going to be exclusively about the arts and entertainment here. And that's a tradition we started in the 60s and, are still very proud to be a part of. I do work non-cinema events once in a while as a bookseller, and I'm happy to step out and do those once in a while, but this is what we do at Larry Edmonds Bookshop. We are the
perfect
arts.
Yes. So I want to focus on the catalog from that Git puts out, the film catalog from 1970, which is the still from the shop, its storefront when it was a block west next to the Pussycat Theater. It's the still from the Paul Mazursky film Alex in Wonderland with Donald Sutherland and Jean Moreau. And I just want to use that as this pediment on which you can look at and describe the scene to us, because this is a scene obviously which has been which has been germinating in Quentin Tarantino's mind, because in his recent film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, your shop is recreated next to the theater, that storefront. So why don't you just jump us, let's throw the lever back like you did with Howard, and let's take us back to 1970 and what's going on.
You know, it is a really golden time in a lot of ways, and very strange that is 50 years ago.
Yeah.
As a memory here now. But that film is part of the legacy and history of the store. I mean, how often do you get two legendary characters like Jean Moreau and Donald Sutherland standing in the front of your store? And the film Alex in Wonderland is also just, it's a very interesting look at Hollywood as well and the filmmaking business and what was happening in the industry at that time. It's an interesting look at the Hollywood Boulevard of that time. And I think it's very easy to attach that, a wonderful sentimentality to what that was. I'm sure the reality of it was still had, dirt under its fingernails and its own sights and smells, but it there's some type of non-corporate, more homespun kind of field for that type of Hollywood. It really is wonderful. And I mean, it's Jean Moreau, come on.
I believe the scene that starts in front of the bookshop with Jean Moreau singing results in this beautiful tracking shot over Hollywood Boulevard with a tank driving down Hollywood Boulevard. So it is this bizarre apocalyptic feel.
It does end with a little bit of chaos in Hollywood. So that part rings true to me too.
Kim, do you want to bring us into focus here with your Hollywood as we sort of wrap this up?
Well, I grew up in the neighborhood and walking up to the boulevard and going book shopping with maybe, a buck in my pocket and buying remainders of Pickwick and dealing with all of the crabby guys behind the counter in the used stores who were all personalities in their own right. That was my childhood. And it's very strange to me to go back and walk the boulevard and there's only you. And I'm so glad you're still there. And I just feel like we need to wrap you up in cotton batting and make sure that your store doesn't just last, but continues to thrive. I don't know what the future is going to bring us, but I love that you're getting dragged, kicking and screaming into the modern age because, we've been bringing people into your store for years. We've come on the Raymond Chandler tour. We wrote a new tour about 1939 books in LA. People love to come into the Larry Edmonds bookshop. Their eyes light up. Their fingers start scrabbling at the shelves. They want something.
They take out $100 bills.
They want to take a little of that magic.
Oh, we need more of them.
Yeah. But my friend, there are people all around the world who can't come to Hollywood. And it's going to be harder for people to travel for a while. And we need to just bring the magic of your store to them. And so that's what you're doing. And I'm glad to see you doing it. I know it's a little outside of your comfort zone. But I think if you look back, what would Larry Edmonds have done? What would Gid and Milt have done? They would have seen what the people wanted and they would have given it to them. And that's what you're doing.
Well, I think it's a 21st century take on, the concept of what made this store great in the first place was, Gid's hustle put those catalogs all across the country. And they created an atmosphere that brought Hollywood to other places in the world. Now, clearly a mail order catalog doesn't have the same emphasis it does now in the time we live in, but I still feel like that concept is what, needs to happen again now. I need to bring this Hollywood to the world. If the world can't come to us, then we bring it to them. I'm very protective of trying to keep the essence of what I believe this store is about. Authors, cinema, scholarship, and a passion for the places that those all connect. And I take that responsibility really seriously here. And when I feel really good about something, and all this flood of not only the GoFundMe, but it has made a lot of people aware that we exist again here, and they have called and they have supported. And You know, I have a woman that was in here a year ago and said, oh, my five-year-old son loved Laurel and Hardy, and you found him this photo book with these Laurel and Hardy pictures, and you have something else for him now because he's six and he still loves Laurel and Hardy. And it makes me, you know, think back to when I was a little kid and my parents would take me to this pizza parlor in my hometown and they'd show Charlie Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy, two reelers in there once in a while. And I mean, I'm here, you know, half a century later, and those things are still important to me. They're still beloved to me, not only because of what they were in them in and of themselves, but also because of those memories that I have from my life that are attached to those things as well. And so for me to think that that little kid out there now is finding those things, and 50 years from now, you know, God willing, you know, Charlie Chaplin, Laurel and Hardy, those people can still be his friends. They're going to be something that he derives pleasure out of his whole life. And just being able to be a conduit for something like that, you know, that's a responsibility that I take really seriously. And so when people say, oh, why do you do what you do if you don't make a lot of money? Well, that's one of the reasons I do what I do.
Yeah, because you can't buy that stuff. You can't buy how good it feels to be the pusher of the classic comedy for little kids. You have the best job in the world.
Comedians and monsters. They're timeless.
Okay, so let's bring this home. You have a GoFundMe campaign. People should contribute.
And buy books.
In addition to, thank you, Kim. In addition to the GoFundMe, they can call you. They can use the contact link on your website, which is going to be on the page for this podcast. And they can buy books from you. So what does it look like to call you or email you about books? Just sort of walk, give us just some parameters.
All right. We're in the process of trying to develop the website and make something that's going to be more user-friendly. In the meantime, I have really used social media as a main force. If you are on Instagram, you can find me at LarryEdmonds1938, or you can go to a specific page I have started called The Library, TheLarebrary, The Library, and that will be pictures of different merchandise we're going to focus on and spotlight, and you can go there and see those things. Go to LarryEdmonds.com, to my website for contact information, or you'll find it on social media. I'm also just under Larry Edmonds or Larry Edmonds Bookshop on Facebook. You can send requests to me any of those ways. You can email me at info@LarryEdmonds.com. Any of those things will happen. I did want to mention a couple of fun things really quick, if I could.
Yeah, of course.
Besides the GoFundMe campaign, that has been such a wonderful blessing. People have stepped up in so many different ways to try to help and contribute. And this Saturday night, May the 9th, which happens to be my birthday as well, so it's a nice little birthday present. Some really good friends of the store, Leonard Moulton and Jesse Moulton, will be doing a thing. They're going to be playing cinema trivia on a website for charity, and Save Larry Edmonds is their charity of choice.
Oh happy my God. That is so cool.
If people want to find that, it is on, it's a page called thefilmstage.com, and they have a hashtag called Cinephile Game Night. And so that's going to be going on this Saturday evening. We're also going to do a promotion this weekend with our good friend Louis Anderson with a bunch of signed copies we have of a book he wrote a couple years ago called Hey Mom, which is the perfect Mother's Day gift for your mom right here. It's a tribute to his mom. They're autographed copies. If you love Louis like we love Louis, this is a really fun thing you couldn't give your mom. And you know, we're going to get more creative in here in what we do. It's what we did with live events and tie-ins with our friends at the movie theaters who we're, you know, praying for right now to get, you know, going again. And, we're going to find ways to keep bringing what we do to people. And if people can't come to us, we're going to get it to you. It's, you know, this is what I do. And, you know, I'm not going to, we're going to keep rolling. The people have spoken, and their love and their kindness and their donations are going to propel us into, you know, making this a better store and something that's still a resource for the next generation of people that want to make films or love films or have any connection like that.
And, you know, they're not just saving your store, they're saving their souls, because we all need each other. We need this sense of community. We need a little distraction and entertainment. And we need to feel like we can actually make a difference. And if it's just one little bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard, I'm really happy we get to be a part of spreading the word. And I know everyone else.
Oh, well, I couldn't be any happier to have you guys bring your tour in here and for all the support and help that you have been, as I have really ridden the roller coaster of emotion the last couple of months.
And hey, Jeff, it sucks. It's been really scary. You know, you've worked really hard. Really,
it's really, really scary. And I've seen, you know, my dark side, and I've seen just the joy that people have brought back to me with their love and support. And I had a talk with somebody the other day who said to me, you know, you're George Bailey. And I really kind of took that to heart a lot, because I really feel like that. And I feel like there's a lot of angels out there that, you know, got their wings because they, you know, they helped me out here, and they really kept this going. And it's really, really meant a lot to me. So it's important that we're going to bring this place back. And, you know, when they walk in the door, you know, if you didn't feel welcome already, we're going to have you come back in, and you're going to know that, you know, you're in a place that, you know, you played a part in an 82-year-old institution in LA, in a place that tears down buildings every chance they get. We are going to still be here, and we're going to keep, you know, we're going to fight to preserve that legacy.
Amen.
That's beautiful. Amen. Can you tell us about little Travis before we go?
You know, it's a lot of days when you're locked up in here, and sometimes, you know, a little toy that can speak emotionally for you or in place of you is sometimes a nice little escape. So little Travis will make some more appearances right here, right now. He has some thank yous to hand out as well.
This is a tiny Travis Bickle.
Oh my God.
Model, right?
It's my little mini Travis Bickle employee here at Larry Edmonds.
Let me just visualize this. I assume this is the Robert De Niro character Travis Bickle in the denouement of the film, once has his mohawk and his M51 combat coat.
Yeah. And you take him out onto the stars of the boulevard, and you take these really wonderful, terrifying photographs of him.
I want him to, you know, speak to some of the reality of this neighborhood when I don't want to.
Okay.
Jeff, before we go, we're going to have one more interview in this segment. We're going to talk to Allison Martino, one of your biggest fans.
Yay.
And she's really going to bring us home with your bookshop in the Tarantino film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So as a segue to that, do you just want to just sort of set up the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and your involvement in that, and just sort of just the story around it, just very, as a nice way just to set Allison up?
It's once again, you know, basically me being the benefactor of goodwill that certainly predates me. But, and by the way, we love Allison, and we love Vintage Los Angeles and everything that she does too. She's always been a big supporter here, and we're really, really grateful for that. I was just basically approached with the idea that, can we recreate the store and have it used in the film? And I was happy to participate in it. As I started paying attention to more was going on, I realized we're basically one of only three businesses that were rebuilt on that block that are still in existence today, 50 years later. And so it was really special. I got to speak to Quentin at one point, who told me that he was honored to put the store in there, because when he was a 15-year-old kid, he would take the bus to Hollywood and he would come up here, and, you know, Peaches Records and Larry Edmonds Bookshop are two places he used to love and come and visit. And so it was a nice throwback for him. And it's, you know, a wonderful opportunity for me to go down and You know, I don't know. That's as close to a time machine as I'm going to get, you know, to go back and see where that was and everything, the way that was recreated for the film. So, I mean, it was really special to be a part of that in Hollywood. It's a memory that I think any of us that were around here will, you know, we'll be talking about it down the road for sure.
Okay, good. Please remind us of the goal for your GoFundMe campaign, and we're going to wish you a good day.
I would just like to say hashtag out to save Larry Edmonds. If you want to help, try LarryEdmonds.com or any of my social media platforms to see merchandise that we have for sale and things that we're going to have coming up. We're going to be here when you all come back, and we're going to be better than ever. And thank you so much to everybody that's played a part.
All right. God.
Beautiful. Happy birthday week, my friend.
Yes. Happy birthday, my friend. God bless, and we'll call you when we publish this tomorrow, okay? Take care.
Most appreciate you, too, all you do. Thank you so much.
My name is Kasten Kansteiner. I am here in Berlin Bistro in Long Beach, and you are listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Allison Martino, I want to welcome you. We just finished with Jeff Mantor, proprietor of the Larry Edmonds Bookshop. So what I would like for you to do, first of all, is to properly introduce yourself, and then we'll jump into the thick of things with Hollywood in the 1970s. So tell us who you are.
Okay. I'm Allison Martino, and I curate the Facebook page Vintage Los Angeles, and I report for Spectrum News about the history of Los Angeles.
Fantastic. So you are gonna bring us home on this episode about Hollywood bookshops, about the Larry Edmonds Bookshop in particular, which is launching a $100,000 GoFundMe campaign to keep it there. The last thing we just talked about with Jeff was Quentin Tarantino's reinventing the shop for his film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I know you did a lot of work with Jeff and Quentin for the film. So go, just take the ball and run.
I'm telling you, that was one of the most exciting weeks I've ever had growing up in LA, was watching Hollywood Boulevard transform back to 1969 for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And Quentin Tarantino's production company allowed us to watch it just on the street. Pedestrians, we would just sit and watch them transform, put everything, all the window displays back, all of the movie theater, the theaters back, and the Larry Edmonds Bookshop was put back in its original location. I was blown away by the production value. I've never seen anything like it. I don't think we ever will again see a movie that not only transformed us back to another era, but to reinvent where they originally were, like where Peach's Records really was. He put that back, where the Larry Edmonds Bookshop, he put that back. That was extraordinary. And it was really exciting to see Jeff see his shop where it originally was. He got to experience what that must have been like.
I love it. So tell us just, if you can, how important is Jeff's bookshop, the Larry Edmonds Bookshop?
Okay, well, I'm going to go back. I'm born and raised here, and I'm a movie buff, okay? So, and I was at a very young age, and I used to take the bus from Beverly Hills all the way into Hollywood, which is, you know, for 12 years old, I was like, I'm going to Hollywood because I wanted to collect movie posters. I was a real cinema buff, so I needed, you know, to go to the Hollywood Boulevard to get what I wanted, which was, you know, maybe imported movie posters or rare books on Hollywood. I was collecting books at a young age too, on the golden age of film in the 70s. And Larry Edmonds' shop was the go-to. It was the heaven for movie lovers. And that place was magic. You would walk in and the posters are, you know, they're all over the walls. The way it's curated in there is whatever you want, there's a section for it. If you're a movie buff, a music buff, a history buff, an LA buff, it's there. And you could count on them to even find it for you if you couldn't find it. And this is way before eBay. So you couldn't, you know, if you were really, really looking for a book or something or a rare poster, you did have to call the cinema shops on Hollywood Boulevard. The other one I used to go to was Hollywood Book and Poster Company.
Yes.
But as far as books, this is the last antique vintage cinema shop that we picture in our minds when we think of a cinema shop on Hollywood Boulevard. That's the one. And because it's 50 plus years old, and it still has the original neon sign, I believe, and Jeff has been curating it all on his own, it would break my heart to see this end, to go away. So yeah, we have to encourage people to go to the book, to call him. I'm sure he's available to take phone calls and ask him what you want.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you call him up and you tell him what you're into and he goes and checks the shelves. I mean, it's the way it's always been. He's in the process of kind of pulling himself into the 21st century and doing more, you know, live streams, getting the website up and running. But in the meantime, he is an old-fashioned bookman. So
he's an old-fashioned bookman, yeah. And, you know, he also, what I so appreciate about Jeff and the Larry Edmonds Bookshop is the when there's a movie playing at the Egyptian, he gets involved with that. So he can do interviews with various book writers, celebrities. They come in, if they've written a book, they go to the Larry Edmonds Bookshop for a Q&A. And he has curated, I don't know, hundreds. It seems like every week he had somebody in there that was just, wow, you know, Carl Reiner, or, you know, some of the people would come in there and do Q&As with him. And because he's so close to the Egyptian, it really felt like a movie experience to see a film and then go to the Larry Edmonds Bookshop and then go to Musso and Frank for a drink. That's my Hollywood. You know, I hit Musso's, I go to a movie at the Egyptian, and I go to the Larry Edmonds Bookshop, all there within one block.
And now all of those wonderful places are all hurting and they all need our help. And it's, wow. I mean, it's just like we've been hit by a cultural tidal wave. But
that movie, you know, the movie Escape from LA? It feels like, you know, all those precious places that we've not thought would never, ever go away, especially when you're just seeing how Musso and Frank just celebrated their 100-year anniversary. And Tarantino putting back all those locations on Hollywood Boulevard and really, you know, creating this new vibe of Hollywood, of people appreciating more of the historic places, are now all closed. You could never have seen this coming, ever. So, yes, I know, I was just looking online and I saw Larry Kaluzewski, screenwriter, excellent screenwriter, had just purchased a ton of books from the Larry Edmonds Bookshop to help him out a couple days ago. And I posted that photo on my Vintage LA page, encouraging people to go on and look to see if there's something they want. But he's just got the coolest books, you know? I mean, you put something, I think Larry bought like 2 books on Angie Dickinson. you know, it's like, I want those books, you know? Or Anne Margaret, her biography. And he'll have every kind of book where you could get a paperback if you don't have a lot of funds. You can get a small paperback or you can get a coffee table book. But he also has scripts, 8x10s, glossies, movie posters. You know, like I said, it's like a heaven for movie lovers. And he really has everything and can probably find you what you want.
Exactly. And he's going to stick around and we're all going to just keep, you know, waving the flag and spreading the word. So when you were a kid, now I used to go downtown for books. Mm-hmm. I used mm-hmm. to go to the Central Library because mm-hmm. I lived in Hollywood and I'd already exhausted everything in my little Gardner Branch library. And I wasn't allowed to do it. I had to sneak downtown because my mother said downtown was too dangerous. So I would get my books at the Central Library and I would hide them under the bed because they had the stamps from Central. Were you allowed to go into Hollywood or was this
No. Absolutely not. But because my house was located off Sunset Boulevard, I was able to take the bus straight through. So it was kind of easy for me.
The number 2 bus, right?
Yep, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I hid the books too. I would put them outside the house and wait for the folks to go to sleep. Or I'd say I borrowed them. I mean, I think my mom ended up, well, my mom did find out. And then she had no choice but to take me there because I would still go anyway. I was a little, you know, cinema shop groupie back in when I was 12 and 13. That's where I liked to hang out, was in the old antique bookshops, Book City across the street there. Yeah. I lived in that place. All my cinema books came from there.
I noticed that the Book City Ghost sign is actually still visible. If you go into that multi-level parking lot behind it and you peep out from like the fourth floor of the parking lot, Book City is still advertised in the alley.
I just got chills when you told me that. I have to see that. Yeah,
So just to orient everyone, so the CRA, the Community Redevelopment Agency of Los Angeles, built a parking lot on the east side of Cherokee, just north of Hollywood. So if you go into that parking lot, you go up to the third level, and you start to look out to the west.
Towards the boulevard.
Yeah, towards the boulevard. You can see the ghost sign on the back of the brick wall. Yeah.
That is incredible. Yeah. Leave it to you guys to find that. Thank you.
Allison, I'm wondering, my passion on Hollywood Boulevard was all the French and Italian film posters that Larry Edmonds stocked. And I just, I was just obsessed. I remember Jeff just brought up his Travis Bickle doll. And I remember the French release for Taxi Driver was just this really terse sort of a man who was alone searching for meaning.
Well, sometimes, the overseas posters were just weird. When I went to France when I was in high school, and I got an Easy Rider poster because it said Kazzy Rider. And I just thought it was hilarious. It was enormous, and they'd somehow swap the C for the E.
I was 12. I was really it was a really exciting time for movies too, and I was really into Spielberg. So I got Close Encounters posters. I had like a Spanish Poltergeist poster.
Ooh.
That was like my favorite poster ever. I got it at the Larry Edmonds bookshop. I still have it. I've got to find it. I had it mounted and on the wall. I had to like take it to Aaron Brothers. You took your posters directly to Aaron Brothers.
Yeah.
And it was just such an exciting thing. I'm telling you, eBay does not have the same satisfaction of getting anything, of your collector of anything. I don't really enjoy, unless it's something I've been really looking for to add to the collection that needed to be there. But I don't get the satisfaction like I did when I would buy a poster at the shop and have him go into the back and bring out what I was looking for. And all the cinema bookshops back then knew me, and they would know what I wanted when I came in, and they would put stuff away from me, and they're like, well, this is what I bought for you this month, Allison. We put these Poltergeist posters away for you. It was just so exciting to spend your allowance money at those cinema shops. And, once again, it's part of my experience today, too, because of the way I still am a movie collector, and there's never enough books, and there's always something you're looking for. And so Larry Edmonds bookshop needs to be known about all over the world. When I was in London, I went to a cinema bookshop that was good, but it wasn't anything like the Larry Edmonds bookshop because he's in Hollywood. So I try to tell the world, through Vintage LA, which is about 400,000 people on there, and they're pretty active around the world, to please go to Larry Edmonds, the website, the Facebook page. However, you can get there and support. And you're going to get a cool book anyway, so, why not?
I love it. Allison, Howard, the Academy archivist, mentioned briefly in his general history of Hollywood bookshops, he mentioned Westwood, which is, I know, a place both you and I spend a lot of time in. And, I haven't had a chance to figure this out since we just interviewed him about half an hour ago, but he mentioned this, and I just remember thinking, oh yeah, right. He mentioned the 24-hour bookshop next to the Fox Theater. Do you remember this?
I remember the 24-hour bookshop, and I haven't thought of it since now.
Were they doing something other than selling books? Because when he brought that up, I thought, there's no way that was just a bookstore.
I remember that bookstore, and I remember they used to have a lot of bins outside to kind of lure you in.
Yeah.
You could get like the dollar book, the 50-cent book. And you'd go in, and it was just books everywhere. It kind of reminded me of the Book City bookshop. But I went to Poster Mat a lot.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes. That was another place to get. But that was more, for me, like Poster Mat was rock and roll posters and stuff, and more rock and roll from what I remember. The rock and roll pins and the magazines and stuff. And then those Larry Edmonds and those were cinema. But they had music movies. So I remember buying a poster from Tommy for a Four and Tommy poster from Larry Edmonds, which I don't have anymore, unfortunately. But, you know, that's, you had the places, you had those stores in LA, you knew where to go to get each thing. Now, unfortunately, people are going to eBay and not supporting these shops or boutiques or little stores. So we have to do that, especially now.
Yes. So,
well, I think eBay's important. As someone who left my straight job because I was buying weird stuff in LA thrift stores that people all over the world wanted, and flipping oddball things like a Green Hornet slide puzzle that I got it out of the closet. 50 cents. I flipped it for $1,100. I went to Australia. It's lots of rock and roll. So, you know, I think we can support the eBay sellers. A lot of them are independents, but we got to keep the Larry Edmonds of the world alive because people are going to be coming to Hollywood again. And when they come, yeah. I want them to walk in that door, smell that wonderful, musty mix of collectible weirdness, and get to meet Jeff because, boy, he's a character and now he's part of history.
So,
and you know what? And he knows movies. You know, Jeff is somebody who not only is a terrific person, makes you feel like you've known him forever, but he knows film. Yeah. So, you know, you can chat with him about your favorite movies, movies you don't maybe you want to learn more about, and he'll help you and he'll guide you to the books that will educate you on directors and filmmaking. And so he's a world of knowledge on top of it. I guess that's what I meant by eBay. I don't have the connection with the person I'm talking to. I'm purchasing something from.
Oh, sure.
I really like to, you know, have the person be. Oh, well, this. I guess with collectors, you like to have a story behind something. Hey, do you know where that came from, or where you? I like having that connection with Jeff.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
All right, so Allison, I'm going to have Kim bring this on home with you. I want you to both step back. We're in week 8 of Mayor Eric Garcetti's Safer at Home Directive. I want you to set up the bigger questions for Allison that we're facing beyond saving Larry Edmonds. So go.
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, everybody here listening, everyone in Los Angeles who cares about our cultural history, our landmarks, our heritage, you know, we're all wondering, what can we do? We're doing the best we can to stay healthy, to keep ourselves in our homes, to keep ourselves fed, to look after our loved ones, to support the first responders, all of that. But at the same time, you know, what you're doing with Vintage LA and what we're doing with the podcast and our social media feeds, it's never been about nostalgia. This is all about a living history that continues to evolve and that we're all a part of. So I don't feel like we're starting from scratch, and I don't think you are either. It's a little overwhelming to see everything we care about challenged at the same time, but, you know, we have the skills. We've been fighting places we care about for years.
Exactly. This is something we've been doing a long time. I guess none of us would ever have expected that this year would have been the most crucial year, that we lose so much as it is. And now with this, you know, we think like Musson Frank and Casa Vega and El Coyote and the places we go to will always be there. Maybe not. And so if we don't support them and go pick up food from, I'm going to Casa Vega tonight. It is Cinco de Mayo. So I'm going to go through the Casa Vega. I want to get tacos and a margarita to go. I've been, you know, getting a lot of food from the Formosa, which has been, they have got that set up terrific. But
and the new menu is wonderful too.
What's that?
The new menu is wonderful too.
So the new menu is great, and they give you a really nice Mai Tai that they put in a jar, and then the Casa Vega, they've got the Tarantino margarita. Because, you know, they shot a lot of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood there. So they were closed for a while. They just reopened again for pickup and delivery. I'm a little concerned about Dantana's. They've been shut down for 6 weeks now. You know, the kitchen's really small. So, you know, I don't know how this works when everything reopens. It's going to be interesting because how many, you know, cooks can be in a kitchen? That's something I work with Dantana's very closely, and I've been speaking with the owner and the chef there, and they've got a lot of concerns of how they can work, because, you know, the bar there is very small, so there wouldn't be able to be a bartender and you wouldn't be able to sit at the bar. it this goes on and on. I mean, there's no instruction book for this. So you don't really know, as a restaurant owner, I don't envy them right now, of how they can survive, how they can come back, especially if they're not landmarked or they're being helped. Look at the Troubadour. They just put up a GoFundMe at the Troubadour.
The Troubadour, I know. And then you see photographs coming out of Holland where they've built these lovely little greenhouses on the canals where people are having intimate meals and they're being served by restaurants that are bringing the food to people who are sitting basically in isolation chambers. You know, it's so progressive. It's a new use of public space. And I look at cities like West Hollywood and LA, and they've just bent over backwards to do everything that they can for big developers. I want to see them bend over backwards to keep the Dan Tanas of the world alive. I want them to figure out ways to, you know, turn what is car space into public space, give people more elbow room, make it possible for these small businesses to do what they've always done, which is to provide for the community. But I don't know. I don't know where we're going to see that or when. I just hope that people can look after themselves until we get to the point where there is a safe way to do it.
Yes, and the only good thing coming out of this is the developers are slowing down a bit on Sunset Strip.
Yeah, some of them. Yeah.
They were supposed to take down a lot of stores up there to put up these massive developments that nobody goes to. By the way,
and nobody. I know it's money laundering. You and I know what that is.
Yeah, I know that. And so you know, the more we know that kind of, the more we get educated on this. We've got to go to those city council meetings. You know, it's really important to fight. I feel like my voice has been strong with them. I'm one person though. And what I love about the Vintage LA community and you is that we all work together in this and get the information out. I try to, especially now in quarantine, my page is more turned to really trying to educate everyone on how developments happen, how they lose their leases and mm-hmm. very greedy landlords and people are getting aware of it, and that's good because, you know, what happened with Stan's Donuts is so unfortunate, and I really do believe that was a rent increase that happened there.
Please refresh for those that don't know what
Stan's Donuts have been there for dozens of years. I don't know the exact date, but it's been there forever. Stan's in his 90s, and that
this
was
is
a
in
sweet
Westwood.
Little... In Westwood, at the, you know, that corner that just anchored the whole village, you know, it was Poster Mats across the street, Hamburger Hamlet, the two theaters, the Fox and the Bruin, the bookstore we were just chatting about. There was an arcade across the, that was like, that was just the greatest area in the 80s, the 70s.
And if Stan was still there, we could walk in there and go, what was the deal with that all-night theater? And I bet he'd have the dirt, too.
Yeah.
Stan would have had the dirt. He was there on Saturdays. And he, I don't think he saw this coming either, but he got a rent increase early this year by a new landlord. And that whole block did, actually. They're all in one building there, and like four or five different shops and all got hit with a 35% rent increase this year. Ugh. Now, I'm sorry, but how many donuts can you think a guy can sell, you know, to stay afloat? So I always feel that they do that in order to, so you leave, you end up leaving. You can't do it. You can't afford it. Now, if these landlords cared about someone like Stan and wanted to keep him in business, then they wouldn't be so greedy because they're obviously still getting their rent. But they want more, and then they want to sell to the developers, and then they want to demolish everything and put up these really ugly glass boxes that nobody goes to, by the way. Those three or four hotels up on the strip are like bankrupt. Nobody goes there. Nobody wants to stay on Sunset Strip anymore because there's nowhere to walk to. There's nothing to see. You know, it's sort of like when you're in Las Vegas, you just kind of stay in your hotel because all the hotels look the same anymore, you know? And that's unfortunate. Thank God the Rainbow Bar and Grill and the Whiskey Go-Go have been landmarked. Thank God. So something looks familiar when you're walking down Sunset Boulevard. But yes, there was supposed to be one where they were going to take the Viper Room down and the Gil Turner's there and build a massive hotel that's way out of scale, way
it's
too big.
It's a very weird building. It looks like a thumb and a forefinger pinching your head with a horizontal garden planted on. It's just a stupid building.
It's like a giant, stunt. Yes, like it's so ugly. I can't even imagine that it's really going to go through. But I was supposed to be meeting with that developer a few months ago until this happened. But now that's all slowed down. So, you know, I don't want to live in a city anymore where I don't have a local bookshop, a local record store, you know, a local market. I don't want to live in a place where it's just Target. It's just, you know what I'm saying? I know, no offense to Targets of the world, but we've got to have a mix.
Target can take it.
Target can take it, exactly.
Right.
You know, that so, Target can take it, but we just can't have the, we can't come out of this and only have that.
Yes.
You know, yes. That's what worries me.
And we're going to stop on that thought because that is the most powerful thought people can take away. We need our local businesses that define, who help us be better Angelenos. This is the concept of effective ownerships. So Kim, would you just quickly, as we sign out, explain what effective ownership is?
Effective ownership is so powerful. It is what makes people, when they hear that something they love is threatened, and they see that they can do one or two things, they can send an email, they can make a phone call, they can share a petition link and sign it, that there's something they can do, they want to be involved because they feel like they actually own a little piece of the Troubadour. They own a piece of Angels Flight Railway. They don't want it going anywhere.
And Stan's Donuts.
Stan's Donuts. Well, they didn't get the opportunity there. But if there's just a little bit they can give back to a place that's in their heart, they're going to do it. What I love about effective ownership in the community is, unlike these lobbyists who have to register every year with the cities where they lobby, and they have to write down how much money they give to the various politicians, which doesn't include the money that they bring in, you know, cardboard boxes and hand over to them at their homes in cash, but it does include, you know, the tickets to Lakers games and so forth. Those people get paid, and if you don't pay them, they don't show up and they don't advocate. But the people in the community who love a landmark and they love a legacy business, you can't shut them up. You can't fire them. And that is absolutely priceless. So I think that what you do is you give people a chance to understand that it's not hopeless, even though it feels that way sometimes. There really are ways of making a difference, of speaking out, of helping to protect the places you love. And we're just going to keep doing that because otherwise Los Angeles is anywhere USA, and that's the last thing in the world this amazing place should be.
Thank you, Kim. Allison,
well said.
Allison, we love you so much. We're so happy.
We miss you.
I know, and when this is over, where are we going to go? We got to go.
We're going everywhere.
Can we go everywhere? Can we do something where we like get together like every week and go somewhere?
Yes. I want to do one of those things where you get, you know, like a drink at one place, a certain appetizer somewhere else. I want to do a progressive historical LA adventure. And we're going to be so full by the end of it, you're going to roll us home.
Oh, I love it. Count me in.
Allison, please take care of yourself. Please give our love to your mom. Please take care of yourself and support your local bookshop.
Oh,
support
yeah.
Larry Edmonds and his GoFundMe. And Allison will be back on here with you soon. And hold on, because once we stop recording, we want to just wrap up with you. So I want to thank, so bear with us through the sign out. I want to thank everyone at home for listening. I want to remind you to continue to listen. Wash your hands. Stay at home, and remember,
you can't eat the sunshine.